At the very young age of 5 years old, James Gardner was peacefully asleep in the backseat of the car when it was hit by another car. The crash was so bad, his mom broke her neck, his younger sister died, and he was left paralyzed down the left side of his body. He would spend the next year in the hospital. Armed with fierce determination and a never-say-die attitude, James began to conquer life on his own terms and regain his ability to walk. He traveled the world. He discovered writing and became an international journalist for elite publications like Esquire. Along the way, his editor asked him to interview Jack Canfield, author of Chicken Soup for the Soul. The conversation deeply impacted James. Jack gave him the advice to take 100% responsibility for his life, a message that truly resonated with James and set him down a path of personal development. Eventually, James set a goal to run the London Marathon, and during a training run, he felt a pain in his head, which turned out to be a brain tumor. James overcame this next obstacle and continued running, this time as a short sprinter. This is an incredible story of grit and determination. This is James's story. But first, a word from my friend, Molly Sider.
Do you feel like you're not where you thought you'd be at this age? Do you feel like you've missed your chance for true happiness? Do you want more out of life? Hi, I'm Molly, and I am the host of I Am This Age, the podcast proving it's never too late, you're never too old, so go do that thing you're always talking about. I interview people who have made big changes after 40, where we get deep into the fears and insecurities felt when they made their change, how they navigated through them, and how you can too. Subscribe to I Am This Age wherever you get your podcasts, and join us every other Monday for the inspiration you need to go do that thing you've always been talking about.
Welcome to Profound Awesomeness, a show about humanity's ability to overcome huge challenges, calamities, and close brushes with death, and turn them into opportunities for growth. I'm Adrian Jones. I'm a heart attack survivor, and it's my mission to share these stories to highlight our capabilities to not only survive, but to discover the profound awesomeness that's within each of us, regardless of our situation. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Profound Awesomeness. I'm your host, Adrian Jones. And today I'm excited for our conversation for a couple of reasons, but we have a milestone today for the show. This will be our first international interview, which I am thrilled to be doing. And I'm joined by James Gardner. James, how are you?
I'm really good, thanks. It's amazing to be your first international guest. I'm honored.
Yeah. And we're honored to have you on the show. Do you mind telling us where you're from?
So I'm from the UK. I'm in Exeter in Devon, which is in the southwest of the UK. So right down near the water and the beaches and stuff. It's really nice here.
Oh, great. All right. Well, thank you so much for making the effort to join us and the time to join us today. Really appreciate it. And let's jump right into it.
Absolutely.
Let's get started and tell us about, we'll start with your trauma and where kind of give us some context, lay the groundwork and the foundation for us. Like, where was it? When did it take place and stuff like that? And we'll go from there.
Yeah, no, definitely. Always a good place to start is at the beginning, I guess. So yeah. So when I was five, so I'm 43 this year, but when I was five, back in 1986, I was involved in a major car crash, that they reported that they're surprised anyone survived. I was rescued and, they thought like my brain was so badly damaged because of like the injuries I sustained. They struggled to get me in a coma. Then I was in a coma for 3 months in hospital and they just thought I was a goner. And then eventually I did learn to breathe unaided. And when I did wake up from the coma, I was had serious brain injury and I was completely paralyzed down the left side of my body. My nan always says that it was like I was a rag doll or like a like Pinocchio and all the strings had been cut. She said I was all floppy and loose and couldn't hold myself up or do anything. So yeah, as a 5-year-old boy, that's really traumatic. So that's where it all stems from. I spent a year in hospital, being rehabilitated. I obviously, couldn't do anything for myself. I remember like being encouraged to pull myself up and sit up by myself. And that was a monumental effort. But I like through sheer determination, I got there in the end. And then obviously over the years, it's always been about learning to walk again and learning like basic motor skills that I'd lost the ability, had to have speech therapy and really learn how to be a person again, how to function in the world. So that's more or less how my trauma came about from a car crash.
Yeah, gosh. And do you remember any details about the car crash?
Not so much. I suppose it was fortunate that I was in the back of the car, and because it was a long car journey, I was asleep at the time. So I suppose that's a good thing that I wasn't actually awake to take on all those images and that like could come back as a nightmare, like in post-traumatic stress sort of situation. I was asleep, so I didn't really remember any of the car crash. I just remember the hospital and what it was like, and then doctors and the nurses coming around and shining lights in my eyes, and I would be like, why are they shining lights in my eyes for, and taking my temperature every few hours. And yeah, just it was really strange to me at the time.
I can well imagine what that had to have been like for you. More questions I have around the car accident. Do you happen to remember, were you wearing a seatbelt by chance?
Well, yeah, I expect I was wearing a seatbelt because my parents would have like made sure I was safely in the back. So yeah. But it was just, it was a really bad car crash because my mum, she broke her neck in the car accident, and my baby sister didn't survive. So it was that bad. So they were surprised, like I actually survived myself.
Terribly sorry to hear about your sister. My condolences.
Thank you. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Wow. So you were asleep and, fortunately you, if there is good fortune in this circumstance, you were asleep and weren't there to bear witness. You weren't awake and conscious to bear witness to this accident or see the opposing car coming at you and, whether it was head on or, the T-bone collision or something along those lines. You know, your story takes me back a little bit to my childhood. I mean, we used to, at your age, Grant, I'm a bit older than you, but growing up here in the States, we would roll around in the back of the station wagon, and we were not weren't a lot of seatbelts being worn when I was that age. That's why I asked the question.
Right, yeah, sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. how it was in the UK in those days, what the seatbelt laws were and stuff like that. So you came to, you were in a coma for several months, and you came around and you're awakened to the left side of your body.
Completely paralyzed. Yeah.
Completely paralyzed. Can you take us back to your 5-year-old self? Like, what were you thinking as you came around and realized like my left side's not working?
Yeah,
what was that like?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was just to me at the time, because I suppose more or less I'd lost my sense of identity, and like I just woke up as a different person to who I was. So for me, it was kind of, it's just the way it was when I came around, and like my left arm not working, that was just the way it was. I didn't have any recollection of what it was like before then or anything to compare it or to, or I just like my arm's not working. So it was just frustrating. And then being told like, you can do it, give it a go, and being driven to to like, there's never, you, there's no such word as can't, and you always have a go. Yeah, like I was telling you about, like being encouraged to pull myself up and sit up in bed. I remember I would like literally grit my teeth and like with all my strength, it would take me to just sit myself up in bed. It was a real struggle. But over time, I got more and more function back. And then, as I said, like the speech therapy, there was this toy they had in the hospital of like, it was, a giant red apple. And if you blew on the apple, a little worm would pop up out the top of it, a little green glow worm, to encourage me like to blow on the apple. Cause like, putting my lips together and blowing, that was something else, that something simple like that. But it, for me, that was a real effort and a real challenge. So they'd have all these toys and equipment things to encourage me to do those things. But yeah, that kind of makes me realize I basically couldn't do anything for myself back then. So to look forward to where I am now, I can really look back on that and think how well I've done to get to where I am today.
Yeah. And I look forward to discussing all that with you, mm-hmm. which is wonderful. Really, really wonderful. And you get out of the hospital. You are, I'm assuming, 6 years old, right? You're in there for a year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did your parents have to, and I'm guessing you, did you leave the hospital in a wheelchair?
Yeah, no, I was in a wheelchair. Yeah. I couldn't walk at that point. I was still very, very, disabled. So could hardly talk. Like my speech, like still needed a lot of work, and my body still had scars and bruises, and still had a lot of recovery to do.
Did your parents have to make a lot of accommodations in their house to, mm-hmm. accommodate the wheelchair and put in ramps and all that kind of stuff?
Well, they didn't so much put in ramps and things, but they did have to, because of where we lived at the time, my mum didn't want to go back there. So we've got quite a close family. They're very supportive. So I went to live with my grandparents because it was near a school that I got sent to, like a school for disabled children. So because my grandparents live closer to that school, we moved in with my grandparents, so that I could go to this special school and have intensive physiotherapy and speech therapy like every single day. The special adaptions were we literally moved out of the house where we were and moved in with my grandparents. And then my dad was working for it was his own company, but had a construction company. So they built a house that was bigger than where we lived. And I suppose, yeah, being bigger, it would have accommodated any special adaptions. I know my dad put in his swimming pool because I did a lot of hydrotherapy. So we had a swimming pool at home so I could continue doing that. Learning to swim and all that. Because I couldn't walk in water, that those type of things are easier. So that was like the main adaption that my family did, was like to build a new house and put a swimming pool in so that I could continue my hydrotherapy at home. Yeah, that was the biggest adaption, I would say.
Got it. And you took a question out of my mouth there. So I was going to ask you where you went to school once you got out of the hospital. So you went to a special school tailored for disabled children. Mm-hmm. And how long did you attend that school?
About three years.
Okay. And then where did you go after that?
So when I was at that school, I did learn to walk again. And I really made a lot of progress. And then I went, my family found a school nearer where our new house was. It's a family run school. So it was quite small. It only had like 40 children in the whole school. So it was quite small and, So that was good for me. It was very supportive. I felt safe. So that was like, I was there until I was like 15 years old. So it really, really helped me. Although I was very different to all the other children, and I don't think they knew how to respond to me. It was because it was such a school intimate place. I was able to learn how to read and write and do all the things that I had to pick up again. I learned how to cope, I suppose, in that special school.
Yeah. And so taking you back to that time in your life, what would you say were a couple of your, I mean, learning to walk, I think, was certainly a big challenge, right? But I'm just wondering what would be, like a couple of your biggest challenges physically and your couple of your biggest challenges spiritually or emotionally that you were dealing with at that time.
Right. Yeah. No, great question. So obviously trying to fit in a feeling, because when you experience trauma like that and you don't really understand what's going on, and then you've got the brain injury aspect as well, I kind of didn't feel like I belonged there. I didn't feel like a person. It was kind of like almost an out-of-body experience, like, because you really dissociate. So learning to fit in and be able to communicate with other people, that was a challenge at that stage in my life. Not really liking myself. I'm still do it. I'm quite good at comparing myself to other people and then putting myself down. So that was a big part of growing up, the like growing into a teenager's type, those years, like, why am I different? And why? And like, I'm not as good as them. Why can't I be like them? And like, I talk different. I move different. I can't join in with sports. And like, here in the UK, we play rugby a lot. And so I couldn't join in with those and like felt left out. So those were big challenges. I wasn't really aware of like the emotional side of things at that part stage in my life. So it wasn't until a lot later I really became aware of I dealt with the emotional side of things and the, like you said, the spiritual aspects. But going back to when I was in that school, because of the brain injury, I suffered a lot with short-term memory. So copying off the blackboard, that was a real challenge for me, because I'd look up and then by the time I'd read what was on the board and then look down, I'd forgotten what I was meant to write. And then writing, that was challenging for me because that was challenging as well. So just like trying to keep up with all the other kids and schoolwork, it was all challenging because of the brain injury, what that caused, and like the short-term memory was a big thing. So that was a frustrating time. I would get frustrated and angry quite a lot, to be honest.
Did you have anything that you held on to that kept you going, or something that you were good at that you could rely on? Well, at least I may not be able to do these other things like these other kids, but I can do this. Anything like that?
Good question. No one's asked me that before. I was quite creative. So I liked building stuff with like Lego. I was big into Lego. So I would like lose myself in like creating a Lego city or Legoland or whatever. So I would like have the escapism of creating building things out of clay, like modeling with clay and being creative. So that was for me, that was a coping strategy, like to make things and be creative. And then I remember in school, like I quite enjoyed even then writing stories, and like when you had essays and they'd give you a title and then you had to make up a story. I think like my mind still worked, and I was able to use my mind. It was like getting my mind out of my head and into the world that was the challenging bit. But in my head, my mind was quite active. So So I enjoyed like creative writing and that side of things as well. And like, as I said, creating things out of Lego or clay or whatever it was at the time. I think that was what kept me going, was being creative and getting that side, being able to express myself in that way.
Well, thank goodness you found that and were able to anchor yourself around those levels of creativity for you. And for you to be able to have a form of expression. That sounds really wonderful. Did you have, like, cognitively, I mean, you had trouble speaking. Were there any sort of other cognitive impairments that you experienced at this time?
Not so much. I mean, just the walking, the, like, balance issues. And because it's almost like brain injury, it's similar to a stroke type thing. I get drop foot, so I would trip up a lot. So like I trip and fall and then injure myself in some other way. So that was like a big issue, was like just the tripping up a lot. And I remember, years I was at school, I would trip up a lot and always spend my time like at the nurse's station getting put back together or whatever it was. So that was like real, took a lot out of me, because when I fall, because I'm quite tall, it would really hurt and then shake me up, and that would create more trauma in my body, I suppose, that I had to process and deal with as well.
So let's move forward. You now are 43. From those teenage years to now, any remarkable milestones that you hit or breakthroughs that you had?
Oh, yeah. They've been quite a few. I've been quite fortunate, and my life's been really colorful and rich. So, yeah. So I'm trying to think when my first, like, milestone moment was, I suppose. Finishing school was a big thing for me, and then then going out into the world, like to get my first job, and then that didn't work out. And then I got another job, and then I got frustrated because I was suffering with depression and anxiety, and I didn't really understand that. So I just get frustrated and angry. And then someone, like, I sought out a therapist, a massage therapist, and she suggested that I go on like a writing holiday. And I did think, why would I want to go on holiday to sit down and write a book or write a big manuscript or lots of writing? Cause at the time I thought writing's like hard work, it's effort. But I quite like the sound of going away. Because I was quite depressed and down on myself at the time. So I went on this writing retreat holiday, really enjoyed the process. And like, there was lots of like-minded people, the spiritual type people, so we all got along and we were all there for the same sort of reasons, to get away from challenges of life. And I really got into the writing process, and we had a writing tutor. He won some Booker prizes, so it was a proper like writing teacher. So I really enjoyed like the process of learning to put all the words together and change it around and then create the story arc and all those type of things. So then I started on that holiday or retreat, I started writing my story. So what I'd been through, like the car accident and then growing up in a world that I didn't feel like I belonged in, and then all the challenges. So I started writing that. I didn't really realize it at the time, but that was quite a cathartic exercise for me to put all my anger and frustration out into words on paper. And then I spent a couple of years writing the rest of my story, because I just wrote the first chapter when I was on the writing retreat in Greece. So I spent a couple of years finishing that off, getting all my frustration and anger out of my body and into this book that I was doing. As I said, it was really cathartic exercise for me. to make sense of the world a little bit more. And then I self-published that book. And then I thought, well, I quite like the writing process. Maybe I can write, do some more writing. So I then got into writing articles rather than a big book. I thought I'll have a go at writing articles. Because I really enjoyed that. And then I thought I could write articles for magazines. So then I did a online course in freelance journalism. And then through that, I did quite well. And then I got offered an internship in a magazine company in Dubai, where my dad, his business had gone to Dubai because it was up and coming. So I was fortunate that a connection he had knew this publishing house who offered me an internship on a magazine. So I was lucky that I was able to go out to Dubai because mum and dad had a villa out there. So I went out to Dubai and then got into journalism working for a magazine. And then, so that was a real big milestone to think that I struggled to get a job and now I'm like working as an international magazine journalist. So I would say that was really epic. And I really enjoyed it. And then from there, I then got known a bit in the company. And then I ended up working for the men's magazine Esquire, as an editorial assistant. So I really enjoyed that job because Esquire covers various topics from fashion to I did a big expose on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And then we did another aspect, on the Arab uprising because that was happening at the time. So I did a lot of interesting work and one of my jobs that I like to do was because it's a men's magazine, we would get business books and I would I'd be sent the book and then I'd read the book and then I'd be asked to interview the author over the phone and then transcribe the interview and then pass it along to my editor and he'd edit it down. So that was one of my things that I liked. And then it was from that job, the biggest turning point in my life really came about. So it was, that job was like my biggest aha thing. Was my editor asked me if I would like to interview Jack Canfield, who I wasn't really familiar with at the time. And then I did a bit of research. And then I found out he's like an American motivational speaker / guru / and I was like, okay. So I stayed in the office one night, evening, and then I phoned Jack's office, in the States and got put through to Jack. And, I wasn't aware that Jack was such a well-known name and like published like all the Chicken Soup for the Soul books and was in the Secret movie. I didn't know any of that. So, speaking to Jack, it was almost like he gave me personal coaching on the call, even though I was like doing an interview for him coming to Dubai to conduct a seminar. But it was on that call, like lots of things like really happened in my head. And Jack said, like, one of the first success principles that he teaches is to take 100% responsibility for your life. And that was like a real big aha, light bulbs went off my head. I'm like, oh, I've never heard that before. Is that an actual concept? And it's always like growing up, it's always been about learning to walk and learning to do this and doing what my caregivers said. And like I said earlier, there's no such word as can't. Like, you just try with all your might, and that being like my driver from growing up, that's all I knew how to do. So then to hear you can have a say in the matter and take responsibility for your own life, I was like, oh, that's ingenious. So like a couple of months later, I had transitioned onto another magazine. It was in fact the first magazine that I interned on. I'd move back to them because I was now a sub-editor, because whilst I was on Esquire, as if I wasn't busy enough, I did another online diploma course in sub-editing. So I then became a sub-editor, then got hired as a group sub-editor for the original magazine I started on. And then because I was a group sub-editor, they had like other magazines under that brand. So I was like in charge of five publications rather than just the one. So I was really busy. And then one of my jobs on the Celebrity Weekly that I was working on was the TV guide. And I had to pick, like, select a movie of the week from the cable channels that were on. And this week it was like the Smurfs 2 movie. So I was like writing about the Smurfs movie. And I was like, I think it was like 10 o'clock at night and I was writing about the Smurfs and I was like, what am I doing? This really is not what I want to be doing with my life. And then I heard Jack Canfield's words echo in my head of like, take full responsibility for your life. And I was like, oh yeah, no, I don't really want to write about Smurfs at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday night or whatever it was. And so I then, like, that put thoughts into process. And then I came to the realization that I didn't want to be doing this and I didn't want to be thousands of miles away from home because my parents had moved back to the UK because I've got three younger brothers back in the UK. So my parents moved back for them and I stayed out in Dubai working on Esquire. So I really missed home and I didn't know it at the time, but I didn't have a support network out in Dubai. I was like really struggling. Not that I would admit it, because I was just trying my best and being driven, because that's to me, that's what you do. Like the stereotype of life, you go to school, then you work hard, then you get a good job, then you work harder on that job so you can make more money and blah, blah, blah. So that was all I knew how to do. So I was like pushing myself to the extreme, really struggling internally, almost like a burnout type of thing. But I didn't know that. I was just struggling to survive, to put a brave face on the thing. And then when I handed in my notice, not really knowing what I was going to do next, but knowing I wasn't happy doing what I was doing, although I suppose to people on the outside looking in, I had a good job. I was working on a celebrity brand of magazines. I got to interview celebrities and work on celebrity brands and things. So I guess you think, oh, that's really good. Like I got to go to VIP parties. And although I didn't enjoy going, I was doing all that. So on the outside, it looked like I was living a really good lifestyle. But on the inside, I didn't enjoy it. I still felt broken. I didn't really feel the zest for life that everyone else had. And I was like, I'm living the dream, but I'm not feeling it. And like, why is that? And then I lived in a big business hotel. They had like apartments in the hotel. So I lived on the 40th floor of this hotel and it was really busy because it was Dubai. And then I would get frustrated because it was so busy and it was so hot and everything. And then when I moved back to the UK, I then did more research on Jack's work and then came across emotional freedom techniques, EFT tapping. And I thought that was really bizarre. Can that really be a therapy that helps people? Then I explored that and then I read a book and then I did some further research and then it got me thinking. And then I came across post-traumatic stress disorder. And then it's like, oh, that sounds exactly like what's been happening to me, because they talk about anger issues, like low digestive system, like not working properly. And I was like, oh, this sounds exactly like what I'm experiencing. So then I did a lot of research, because obviously being a journalist, I was in research mode most of the time. went on a course to learn EFT myself. So I spent a long time, and I'm now an advanced EFT practitioner myself, because EFT really helped me. I went to see a counselor about PTSD, and then he said to me, "Have you ever dealt with your emotional trauma, and have you ever felt abandoned?" And I was like, "No." And like, my trauma happened like when I was 5, and I'm now, I think at the time I was like 37 or something. I was like, surely any trauma has worked itself out by then. And when I went on this EFT course, I didn't know what really to work on, because I was so disconnected from my body. I thought, oh, I'll work on this abandonment thing. And then I was tapping through all the points and like this abandonment and all these type of things. And then that really transformed me. And it's like I almost arrived back in my body just because of tapping through those issues. And for those of who don't really know what EFT is, it's basically, it almost combines psychology with with the acupuncture. So it like combines the two, like you tap on these acupuncture points on your body. And I thought it was really out there to begin with, but it really transformed me. I almost, like I said, like became alive again in my body. I was able to feel myself. Like, I remember like at the beginning, the tutor who was teaching it, he goes, "That anxiety, where is it in your body? And then what color would it have?" And I was so dissociated that I wouldn't know where it was in my body. Like, and then after a few months of doing that EFT, I like really came aware more of my body and the sensation. So I would then know where the anxiety was coming up and how it was affecting me. So that's really where I became aware of more the emotional aspect of trauma and what it was doing to me. Cause for years growing up, it had always been about my physical rehabilitation, learning to walk, learning to do the heel toe because I had the drop foot, learning to pull my pelvis round because I broke that in the accident. So it was always about learning to walk and talk and all those type of things. It was never about how's James feeling or what does it feel like to not be driving all the time. That was like the big, that job in Dubai, if that had not happened, I wouldn't have been asked to interview Jack Canfield. And then I wouldn't have become aware of VFT. And then I wouldn't have done the research. And then because learning about PTSD, I was like, well, why has no one ever mentioned this to me before or said, have you dealt with your emotional trauma? And this is what's going on in your body because of the trauma. No one had ever said that to me. And I was so shocked that I thought the world needs to know this. So I then wrote another book about all the PTSD research I'd done. I'd put that into a book and thought the world needs to know this because I don't want other people to struggle like I have for as long as I had. Being dissociated, disconnected from the world, like really like living angry, like with society and not really knowing who they are. I like didn't want anyone else to suffer for so long unnecessarily. So I then penned my book about PTSD and trauma and how to heal from that. And then the art of connecting with your body and how the process of that works and what that looks like. So yeah, if I hadn't have done all of those things, I wouldn't have got to where I am now and learning to be who I am because of writing that book and doing that interview with Jack Canfield and then connecting all the dots and then doing all the further work. And then I went on to do a lot of work with Tony Robbins as well. So then I really became aware of personal development. And it was that personal development that really shaped me rather than the physical development. It was then the personal development because like for years I'd been dissociated. So I wasn't a person. So it's really about developing the person. So yeah, that was like my big, it's kind of long winded, but that was my awesome, my like how the awesomeness bit evolved in my life.
Thank you for sharing all that. And as you're talking, I'm wondering too, your left side of your body. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm doing a little jump here, but on the left side of your body, are you still able, like, are you able to walk and like,
yeah,
what is
your functionality? I can still walk and everything. I'm just, my left side is a lot weaker. So I walk with a limp because my left knee turns in, and that. So that's still a challenge. Although I mentioned Tony Robbins there, when I went to a Unleash the Power event, with Tony Robbins, I was fortunate enough. I got to go to Florida to Palm Beach to do that. Whilst Tony was talking, he was like, people who have done like out of this world things, like gone to the moon or won an Olympic gold medal, that they come down to Earth. Once they've achieved that monumental goal, they come back to Earth and then they get depressed because I've achieved that amazing thing. So now what? And I was like, kind of put that into context and thinking, oh yeah, I've done this amazing thing and like learned to survive and learned to walk again. So maybe I need something bigger to think about. So then I thought, well, maybe I could like run the London Marathon. And I was like, well, is that like too big of a stretch goal? But it was like that really stretched myself. Like we talk about in personal development and coaching, we talk about like getting out of your comfort zone. That's where all the transformation happens. And I've been living in my comfort zone because it's comfortable and it's familiar and it's safe. But yeah, no, I came up with a crazy idea of running the London Marathon and could I do that? So then I came back to the UK. I applied for a charity place, with, the brain injury organization, brain injury charity Headway here in the UK. So they gave me a charity place. So I was like, oh my goodness, this is really happening. I have to run this marathon now. So I was like, well, can I even run? I struggle, like walking is hard work. So then like I had to learn to run. So then I got a running coach and then I got a sports coach. And then I, yeah, like put all my effort into learning to run and talk about being driven. My sports coach would often say, you try too hard, just relax and go with the flow more. And I was like, I have to do this. And then I really got competitive into the running side of things. And then during the time I was training for the marathon, I then found out I had a brain tumor. So that was a shocker. I had been doing like a 17K training run and noticing like the pressure build up in my head, like someone had stabbed me in the head and I wondered what that was. And it turned out to be this brain tumor. So because of that, I had to withdraw from the London Marathon, which was disappointing. But because I then got into, my coach said, well, you can't do long distance running because of the pressure and everything. But how about you try for short sprinting. So I then got into 100 meter sprinting. And I really enjoyed that because I became, because I am uber competitive anyway. I was training with other sprinters, so then I had like a benchmark to measure my success about. And yeah, I did really well with that. And then when the tumor got dealt with, I had a surgery, had a big brain surgery, like big 12-hour surgery. But because I was like more or less a competitive athlete at the time, my resting heart rate was like 48 and like my stats were like the medical team had to make special provisions on the notes that I was a competitive athlete. It wasn't that my heart rate was so slow because it was failing. It was because I was so fit and well that, like, I made such a good recovery, and I was only in the hospital for 2 days rather than the week that they thought I would be. And then 3 days later, I was back out running, which in hindsight maybe wasn't such a good thing to do, but I just wanted to know whether I could still run having had the brain surgery. So I just, like, was testing the waters, so to speak. So it was because of all that getting into sports and learning to run and then becoming uber fit and competitive that I was able to make such a good recovery and deal with the brain surgery. That side of things had an upside to it. Although I was devastated that I had to withdraw from the London Marathon, it made, like, they talk about if you have a goal, it's more about the person you have to become to achieve that goal. So I'd become this competitor of athlete. I got classified as a para athlete with British Athletics. So it was about, like, I'd become this really fit person. I was really strong. I don't run anymore because of an injury, because of, I mentioned earlier, my dropped foot. I would trip up a lot. So I injured my knee a lot. So I've sustained a lot of knee injuries. So after the brain surgery, I wasn't really feeling like, I didn't lose who I was, but, like, I sort of changed a little bit, and I wasn't really getting the thrill from the running so much. And because of the injury, I kind of didn't feel the drive so much for that, but I still really enjoyed the competitive and the sport. So I then got into shot putting and different, more field events rather than track. And then I enjoy working out in the gym, because I found out from sports, from working out, you get the endorphins. And they talk about, like, doing gym or sports that helps deal with depression. So that was really my driver, was the endorphin high helped me with my mental health. It was a way to deal with that side of things. So yeah, I still go to the gym 3 times a week or four. Yeah, sometimes four. I used to go 6 times a week because I used to do box exercise as well, do lots of things. So keep myself active. Fitness for me is an escapism and a coping mechanism, because it's a way for me to deal with my anger and the depression side of things. So people might have heard, like going to the gym or engaging in sports, even just going out for a walk in nature, really helps with depression and stress and anxiety. And I think I'm proof that is real, because that is how I cope with life, is go to the gym or get put on my punching gloves and, yeah, just getting out the anger that is in my body. So I would definitely advocate that.
Your story is one of grit and determination and resilience, a competitive fire within you. There's no doubt.
Yeah, no, thanks it for is, saying that.
Yeah. It's a source of inspiration to hear you talk and share some of the things you were tackling or tackling, and it's wonderful. I'm wondering for you now, how does profound awesomeness manifest itself in your life?
Great question. I think, although my life, like when I wrote my first book, it was almost like a tragic story. It's like there was a lot of woe me and tragedy. But all that has added up to who I am today. Like, as I said, I went to Dubai, I became a journalist. I then got to interview people. And then I ended up going to Asia and teaching English in China and in Thailand. And I got to travel a lot. And I think all those things, and like the athletic, doing the athletics and going to competitions and being surrounded by able-bodied athletes, and then realizing, wow, am I part of this? Am I good enough to be doing this? I think all those things have added up and made my life kind of awesome, like, to be able to share my story and people like think, oh wow, like you're really like you said, like the resilience and the fire. And had I not experienced everything that I'd gone through, I wouldn't have that resilience. I wouldn't be so driven. I suppose like it's given me a lot. Like now I use all that to bring it into my work, to my writing, to my, I'm now into coaching to help people with the psychology and the mental health side of things. I've got a lot to draw from because of my life is quite rich, and having had three near-death experiences, that kind of makes me, that is my USP, my unique selling point to put myself in out in the world. It's like I'm completely different to probably most of the people that you've come across. So I relate to a lot of people who have experienced trauma in different areas. The trauma response in the body is pretty much the same no matter how you experience that trauma. You still go into the fight and flight response, and it's still the same process to get back into that and deal with your trauma and to become a person. It's still the same process. And because I've like living example of coming out of rising out of the ashes, I don't like using metaphors like that, but it's the best way to describe it, is like I talked about putting my life back together. It like I have the insider experience of actually putting all those pieces back together in a way that makes sense. I remember Jack always said, like, success is like a combination padlock. Once you know the numbers and you put them in the right order, the lock has to open no matter what. So for me, it's been like learning all the numbers and then working out which order they go in to unlock that and return to living and being a person that's able to function in the world and like learning to like yourself again, learning to create a life that you like. So a lot of the coaching work I do, it's about who do you want to become? What are your goals? What are the obstacles? Obviously I've had a lot of obstacles, blips in the road, I like to call them. So I've learned a lot of resources to help me get over those little blips in the road, although they're, to some people, they look like catastrophic events. To me, because I've had to be so resilient, like they're just little blips in the road to me. So people go, well, like that's a huge thing. And to me, it's like, oh, it's only a little scratch. Like I've been on death's door three times. So I think when you've experienced like near death or like severe trauma, little things aren't so daunting, but to other people who haven't experienced mass trauma, the big T trauma, to them it's a big thing. But when you've dealt with big issues similar to myself, it makes other things seem less daunting because I've overcome so many other big challenges. All the little challenges just seem like, yeah, little bumps in the road that's no biggie because of how rich my life has been. And I suppose it's made me, I call it like, I would say my skin's quite thick now. So it takes a lot to knock me down because of that fire and resilience that you speak of. So my awesomeness has been from like my life experience of me, like me, like my life awesome and like me, like who I am, I suppose, awesome. Although I still get my down days. I still wouldn't say that every day is awesome or every day I'm happy and want to go out and take on the world. But because, yeah, all my awesomeness is all the events and challenges that I've had to face, that's been really awesome because it's made my life awesome and rich and colorful. And I can write because I like writing. I enjoy writing. I enjoy connecting with like-minded people. It makes it easier for me to relate to them, to know where they are. Like I've speak to a lot of people who have experienced brain injury or trauma, and they're like, oh wow, this is the first time I felt listened to or understood, or this has been an amazing conversation. And I just feel really overjoyed, like when I'm able to connect and resonate with people on that level, that actually they feel heard and understood. Because when you don't feel heard and understood, you just feel frustrated and I don't belong in the world. So to be able to connect and resonate with people, that really lights me up inside. So I think that's what's where my awesomeness is the ability to connect and help other people. So I'm really fortunate, I suppose.
Isn't it wonderful being in service of others?
There's absolutely, so much purpose and I love meaning it. Yeah.
It's a wonderful place to be.
Yeah, to give life meaning. It was really, for me, it was like I left Dubai because I wasn't happy and I wasn't fulfilled. It was like that fulfillment I've been searching for my whole life. That was why I still felt lost and alone, because there was no fulfillment. I didn't feel a sense of belonging or purpose. And so now I feel that purpose and fulfillment in being in the service of others. Yeah, absolutely.
You indicated earlier that at some stage in your adult life, you said you still felt broken. Now, after everything you just said, is there a part of you that still feels that way or no?
Great question. I'm probably say no, that I don't feel broken. But then on the flip side, it does depend what day it is, and how many other because I've got a large family, it's how much exterior like family drama is going on, and other external challenges are going on. All that can soon overwhelm me a little bit. But when I because I'm big into meditation now, and that's something I never ever thought I'd be able to do, being able to sit still when you're in trauma, you can't, your head's not still at all. To find stillness is challenging, but I can now find that stillness, that equilibrium, that come back to center, to connect with your essence, that core of who you are. Now I can center myself and really be in the moment and enjoy that. Like just yesterday, I was sat out on the balcony. It was a nice day and I was just sat there with a cup of coffee, just able to like to take a deep breath and relax and feel the seat and just enjoy the moment. That's something that for years I wasn't able to do. So to now, like when there is a lot going on, like a lot of family drama or a lot of external drama, that has influences on me. When I can come back to my center and realize it doesn't belong to me, that like it's only external stuff. When you can connect yourself and you truly have an identity and you've done a lot of inner work, and I help people a lot with setting boundaries. And that's, so when you know who you are deep down, it's harder for the world to knock your world off its axis. So having a true sense of identity and belonging in the world, that for me is a big part of healing and knowing who you are. So, and that's where I don't feel broken anymore, because I know who I am. I've got that sense of identity. I've got boundaries in place. So it's harder for people to cross those boundaries and knock me down, because I know if they say something, I'm just like, that's not true. I know inside I'm good enough. That what they're saying, that's their words. I was very fortunate to speak to Dr. Wayne Dyer, who passed away a few years ago, God bless him. But he said and then teaches like other people's opinions of us are none of our business. And that really resonates with me now. I'm like, what other people think of me it's got nothing to do with me. It's not important. Like I need to take care of my own energy and use my own energy efficiently to propel myself forward, and to waste it on other people's opinions of me is not a good use of my energy. So I tend not to do it so much. So I tend not to, because I know who I am deep down and have a strong sense of that, I don't feel broken. And I think I'm robust enough and I've got that resilience that it takes something catastrophic to knock the wind out of my sails.
You know, for you, it won't be long if that does ever happen to you again. I'm quite certain of it. Right. So I'm so glad to hear that you say that you're not broken anymore. That just, it filled up my soul and my cup, so to speak, to hear that and to know that you feel that way.
I really feel the connection because I'm quite spiritual now. I spent about 3 years exploring spiritual development and that side of things as well. And I talked about meditation. So really connecting with myself and the spiritual side of things, that's a big part of it. So I really felt the connection as my words came out. I really felt that you connected with that. So thanks for saying so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you're a coach, you're an author. How can people, if they want to follow you or get to know you better, how can they track you down?
Thanks for asking, giving me the opportunity to share my help. I want to just help the world, as many people as I can. So I really appreciate this opportunity. Yeah. So my website is www.coachjames.uk. And then I also got the Instagram handle coachjamesuk. So it's at coachjamesuk. I'm on Facebook as well. You can find me on there. I've got Coach James business page on Facebook, and I'm also on LinkedIn and quite prolific on Instagram and LinkedIn primarily. On my website, I have got a free download. So if people want to download I've called it a quick start guide to healing from trauma. But because I know we all want things to happen really quickly, we all want to take a magic pill and life be better, but it doesn't quite work like that. But I have made a quick start guide so you can get started. But then I've got my other book, How to Heal from Trauma and PTSD, Your Ultimate Guide to Becoming the Person You Want to Be. That is available worldwide on Amazon, as a paperback and Kindle, book. So there's that book, which goes more in depth into trauma and PTSD and the fight and flight response. But my, quick start guide is, I think it's an 11 page PDF. The three steps, these are the three starting points really. So you're more than welcome to go to my website and download that as well, or reach out to me on Instagram or Facebook or message me. And I really appreciate, being able to help, because I know Jack, when I was interviewing Jack, he talked about, one of the success principles is learning to ask. Because I know when we're in trauma, and especially for me, we want to show that we're strong enough that we can cope on our own. So asking for help, something I really struggled with for years. So just being brave enough to ask for help or guidance or get support that is a really monumental big thing. So just asking for help or support, or just a simple message on Instagram or wherever. I'd just love to connect with anyone who feels they would appreciate some support. That would be awesome.
That would be profoundly awesome, as they say. So, okay, so that's coachjames.uk for the website, and at coachjamesuk for social media. I'll have that in the show notes.
Okay.
And then speaking of social media, I should also announce that we now have a Profound Awesomeness Instagram account, profound_awesomeness on Instagram. Would love to see you there. We're just getting that up and running. So, James, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and taking the time today to do that. I'm grateful and so appreciative of your time and your story and your wisdom. Yeah, I as well.
Thank you so much for having me and giving me this opportunity to help serve more people.
I'm sure you're already helping people, and to the people that you will help going forward, how wonderful. And hopefully this message here today will get out. And, you know, I've said before, I'll say it again. I mean, if we can just help one person, we've made a difference.
And yeah, imagine absolutely. If we then,
and then help more and more on top of that. So let's cheers on that, so to speak.
Yeah. I really appreciate that. Thank you, Adrian.
Yeah, you bet. And thanks for coming on the show, James. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, I was the first international guest. Hopefully you'll
inspire
more.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm so honored about that. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Have a great rest of your day, and thanks again for your time.
And you too. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. We'd love your feedback. Please be sure to rate and review and subscribe to Profound Awesomeness wherever you download your podcasts. If you have a story to tell, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at profoundawesomeness@gmail.com.